So we can start on being creation's advocate and how to become an advocate for God's creation in today's culture. And I'm going to start off. So I know it's small. I apologize. The Canticle of the Sun by Saint Francis. Most High, all-powerful, all-good Lord, all praise is yours, all glory, honor, and blessing. To you alone, Most High, do they belong. No mortal lips are worthy to pronounce your name. We praise you for all your creatures, especially for Brother Sun, who is the day through whom you give us light. He is beautiful and radiant with great splendor of you, Most High. He bears your likeness. We praise you for Sister Moon and the stars in the heavens. You have made them bright, precious, and fair. We praise you for brothers wind and air, fair and stormy, all weather's moods, by which you cherish all that you have made. We praise you for Sister Water, so useful, humble, precious, and pure. We praise you for Brother Fire, through whom you light the night. He is beautiful, playful, robust, and strong. We praise you for Sister Earth, who sustains us with her fruits, colored flowers, and herbs. We praise you for those who pardon, for who love of you bear sickness and trial. Blessed are those who endure in peace. By you they will be crowned. We praise you for your sister death, from whom no one living can escape. Woe to those who die in their sins. Blessed are those that she finds doing your will. No second death can harm them. We praise and bless you, Lord. Give you thanks and humbly serve you. So I chose Canticle of the Sun because I think it hits most of the elements that I wanted to talk about. But I also chose it because when I think of St. Francis, I think of his commitment and his example of bucking culture, bucking his day's culture, and supporting creation in all that he did. And if someone wouldn't mind, could someone else read God's covenant with Noah?
Yeah, I'll do that. As for me, I am establishing my covenant with you and your descendants after you, and every living creature that is with you, of the fowl, of the cattle, and every creature of earth with you, from all that go out of the ark to every beast on earth. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall eat all flesh, or shall never again shall all flesh be cut off by waters of a flood, and never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. This is a sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all generations. I have set a bow in the clouds, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth.
So it was wonderful to see that rainbow over Holden on our walk today. So I think that God's covenant with Noah is a promise that we keep. You know, it's a promise that he keeps with us and we keep with him. So, as we know, it's important for for creation care, for us to care for the creatures and the people. So I think that it's, to me, it's always been a promise, and it's been a real beacon in my life. So we talked yesterday about challenges for God's creation. And these were some of the things that we talked about. I've had a couple of really good conversations about the loss of connection to Earth, the lack of awareness, kind of that nature is enemy. And there's a lot of the blame game. It's not my fault, and I haven't done anything bad, so why should I have to make sacrifices? So it's the not in my backyard, but I still want to drive my BMW. So it's things that, it's attitudes that we have to combat, really. And it's also a challenge to get people who are so plugged in, unplugged enough to even take walks outside and connect with creation. I mean, how do you talk to them? What incentive do you give people? And it's not just, you know, my daughter's generations, it's us as well. I mean, some of the things I've seen my generation do are just scary. And I just am like, whoa, what are you doing? To each other, to relationships, you know? So I think that it's really important to, how do we get to where we can get back that connection to the earth? I tell a funny story about a friend of mine who's a lawyer in Seattle, and she was visiting us, and we were making dinner together. And so I asked her if she could go out and pick some lettuce from the garden and maybe harvest a tomato or two for our salad. And she was like, you lettuce in your garden? You know, I was like, yeah, it's just out in the garden. And I sent my four-year-old out with her. And I said, Kristen, go show her where the lettuce is and the spinach so we can pick it and have salad. She goes, okay, I'll show her. She comes back in and, you know, they've got the lettuce in a bowl and stuff, and I start making the salad, and she goes, don't you have to irradiate that somehow? She goes, you can eat stuff that just grows in your backyard?
In the dirt?
In the dirt. So, there's this, you know, tremendous loss of connection. And I don't get it. But, you know, very, very smart people are not connected. They just don't understand. Some don't understand where their food comes from. Some don't understand the importance of a species and how it works into an ecosystem. That's really scary. And I know that Disney's done a good job of trying to teach our children about the circle of life, but it's just not been enough. It's not getting through. And I don't know where we need to go to get them there, other than take them, right? Take them on the journey with us. One of the things that we talked about yesterday were sustainability goals and community development. And so one of the things I'd like to know are, what are things in your community that you think are so important, that are gifts, creations, gifts to your community, that you need to keep, and you want to keep and not let go of, and you want others to know of it. So I'm going to ask you to think about that and see whether or not you want to write some of those. We'll write them down together. You want to write? I would be happy if you want to write.
All right.
I would say parks and green spaces on our, I live on an island, and they're working like everything to try to maintain the greenness.
Mm-hmm. We live in a small town that has a lake, so, I don't usually go there, but I know a lot of people enjoy it,
mm-hmm.
And just to keep it healthy and the wetlands around it.
Mm-hmm. So the lake and the wetlands. Can you put wetlands too?
Mm-hmm. We have both of those things, but one of the things I like about where I live, a stated goal of the village is sustainability,
mm-hmm.
and in particular, walking. And so not only do they make sure, because we're right first tier off of Minneapolis, make sure the sidewalks are in place, in
mm-hmm.
good shape, but in the winter the city gets out there and cleans them so that we can keep walking. To me, that's a very important
mm-hmm.
component of our community. And also a stated goal of encouraging pollinators.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of rain gardens and a lot of the city really is out trying to help people do that.
Right. That's good. We have got some community gardens where people can grow flowers and food.
And we have farmers markets that come, a number, even in our small community. Then Minneapolis is loaded with them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, the farm-to-table concept.
Right.
All locally grown.
My parents live on an island, and the island has been under development. The island was an Everglade island, and it somehow or other was developed, and the developer carved channels throughout the island so that he could get more money by offering waterfront property.
That's sad.
So it's all carved into channels. And so it's a big channel system. I don't know what it looks like from the air. It looks all chopped up. But one of the things that they have is they have box turtles, and they have burrowing owls that are endangered species. And they're supposed to not develop property where the burrowing owls have set up their burrows. And they're also supposed to leave a buffer for any turtle nests and things like that. They also have a huge seabird migration area. And that again is for egg laying and for turtles and things like that. But the burrowing owls, they really get the short end of the stick. Because when I first got there, my parents moved there 22 years ago, when we first got there, I thought, oh, good. Well, they're at least doing something. You know, once the owls have burrowed, they set up a perimeter for the owls. No one can go within it. And you can't do construction on that property. So I thought, oh, well, that's cool. They'll at least have pockets of property where the burrowing owls can all go, and they won't ever, you know, be evicted from the island. And most of the other areas around them don't have burrowing owls anymore because of people bringing in their pets, so cats mainly. And so it was just really very strange to me to come the next year and see that where last year there had been a burrowing owl, you know, habitat that someone was building. I was like, I went to my mom and dad. I said, why are they building there? That was where the burrowing owl came. And, oh, well, they'll go to another property. It's okay. I'm like, wait a second. I thought they weren't supposed to build on that property if the burrowing owls were there. Well, when they leave and they migrate, after they raise their young, they let the property owner then develop. Well, imagine over 22 years, has there been any space left untouched, undeveloped in this extremely expensive, you know, place to live? So my parents' next door neighbor had bought an additional lot and they were going to build a house, and that house was going to, you know, be their, like a, you know, Airbnb for them and bring in income. They have not developed that property. Every year there's a burrowing owl family or two in that property. So that's the kind of commitment it takes. Government's not doing a very good job of it. And for us to save species and save habitat for species, it's taking personal dedication, personal advocacy to really make it happen. Does anybody else think of anything that you want to keep? What are the connections you want to keep with creation?
Our community in Washington or around Bellingham has got several natural salmon runs. The Coho, the Sockeye, the Kings. They come at different times of the year. And it'd be nice to keep them around. Not only is it food, but it's, for us, it's food for the bald eagles that come down for winter in the area. So,
it's food for the orca. And if we don't keep it, we're going to lose our orcas.
So, I'd like to keep the salmon runs.
In our area in southern Wisconsin, we have a creek that runs through our village and down to another lake, for way, 20 miles away or so. But along this creek, there's kind of a wetlands. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty much all owned by farmers. And a number of years ago, a farmer donated a good amount of that wetlands to the county. And that's been going on until recently. They've added some major chunks more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they keep adding. And farmers on either side end up not donating, but it becomes a pro. It's,
mm-hmm.
you know, they sell it. They do sell it to the county
mm-hmm.
park system. And so that park just keeps expanding, and
mm-hmm.
the wetlands get protected. So it's an investment that the county and the villages are making. And then there are some of us that go in, and it's gotten a little more organized, but we were doing this before it got organized. So cutting trees, especially invasive species trees, and clearing out some of the invasive brush
mm-hmm.
Plants that are in there, and just maintaining the gift that's there.
Mm-hmm.
first started as that area was somebody in the little town of Rockdale, which is, you go there and you go, what? And it's not even hardly a village. And one street through, and then a side street that goes another way, and that's about it, a few houses. Well, they had the fantasy back in the 1800s when Wisconsin was going to move its capital, that they put their name in for a bid. Mm-hmm. And they started building a railroad from a main line that was about, well, at least 10 miles north, maybe only 5 miles north. They were going to do a spur, railroad spur down there. So they graded and put in, through this wetland, a raised bed for the railroad. But before they even put in the trestles, they were out of the running. Mm-hmm. But that all that high land is still there.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's beautiful. Hiking trails, walking trails, and they do winter sports.
Yeah,
cross-country skiing and mm-hmm. snowshoeing. And they add trails off of it, and they've got a super thing of mountain bike or off-road bike kind of competitions there and stuff that they have. Mm-hmm. And those trails are kind of a bit of a pain and not exactly friendly to the environment. But some of that is some of the give and take to really protect the wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
Having the hills chewed up a little with these bicycle people running all over.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a real asset. Mm-hmm. And you can go down there and you can actually hear frogs and see frogs and cranes and other wildlife. Yeah. It's great.
When we, I was working on a project recently where they put a rail spur in and it went, into a wetland buffer area. And so we thought, oh, we're not too, you know, the project's not in too bad of shape. It's not really going to impact the wetland that much. We brought in a wetland specialist and he said, well, your problem is that you're going to have that raised bed rail and there's no connectivity. The upland part of it provides the water for the wetland.
Right.
So you're going to have to do something about that. So the wetland design, or the rail spur design, included these little geotextiles underneath the bed that have like a webbing that water can pass through underneath the bed. So we were able to keep feeding the wetlands, even though we have the raised rail spur. So there is, you know, people thinking about it, which is really great. So they're trying to reduce the impact of those trails and reduce the impact of the rail.
The other thing in our community is they're kind of one of the trees of the nation or trees of the world communities or something in there, in some registry someplace,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all the different varieties and species of trees in town. And they just keep planting trees. We do have the ash borer. That's, I don't know, ash borer that's going through. And there's about, in this village of 1600, 1400, you know, there's like 1,000 trees that have to come down.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, the bigger ones, they're working to protect.
Mm-hmm.
And some are need to come down. But instead, they're also planting all other, and they keep, there's people that are just committed to
mm-hmm.
planting new trees.
That's great. That's a wonderful commitment to make.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Plant more trees.
Yes, absolutely. Plant more trees.
Well, if you have a mature tree canopy in your village, and in your town, it's going to cool the temperature
mm-hmm.
quite a deal.
Yep.
And it use less air conditioning.
Right. It does a great job of cooling.
Yeah.
You know, the evapotranspiration just did a fantastic job. So
Minneapolis has gone to, we can recycle anything, and they've got some separator that takes
mm-hmm.
care of all that. But now a lot of the communities, mine has not yet, but I think it'll come soon, where you can put compost out.
Because
like I have no place to put compost, I live in
mm-hmm.
a townhouse.
Yeah.
But they'll pick it up and take it to a compost site, mm-hmm. which is new for us. And
yeah.
the city of Minneapolis is really committed to that.
That's great. That is a wonderful commitment. It really is. Compostables is it's a good way to be able to get it there back into dirt faster. Mm-hmm. Reusable soil faster. That's really wonderful.
They did it. In Germany, mm-hmm. family in Germany, and they have the waste wheelers. Well, one of them is just for yard and household mm-hmm. waste recycling.
Yeah.
And there, they even include meat and meat byproducts in their compost.
Wow.
However, they handle that.
It's just a different bacteria that's going to.
That's right.
Compost
yeah.
it.
But it all gets crunched up and.
Yeah.
Do they combine the yard waste with the food compostable?
Yes.
We were having a little discussion at our townhouse about whether or not to do that.
Yeah.
I'm losing. I was hoping to be able to
But it has to come from whoever is kind of the top of the chain of control of handling the recycled material wherever it goes.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
The townhouse department can't. Community can't just decide they're going to compost meat byproducts.
Oh,
and
no,
it,
I understand that, yeah.
Not be accepted down the road.
Yeah, it's pretty. We have a friend who works for sanitary services, and he's always keeping us abreast of what the changes are and what they're doing. And we recycle a lot of plastics, and so. It's always great to get up to speed from him as to what the latest trend going on in the United States. So
there was a
global
activist in the 60s, Saul Walinsky or something like that. I can't remember for sure his name.
Mm-hmm.
But he promoted change by overwhelming the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the system says, We don't recycle plastic bags. But if everybody put their plastic bag in the recycle container, pretty soon they'd figure out there's so many of these we need to recycle
mm-hmm.
and what to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as you play the game, the system doesn't change. So
yeah.
He was very much proactive in
uh-huh.
social change.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think that those are all wonderful things that we want to stay connected with. Definitely. Can you put my orcas down? So I found this wonderful discussion about dominion today. And I just thought it was so it was on the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. And I thought it brought out some really true perspectives about where we've been on dominion. So the first one is...
I'm just reading myself.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay. So... It is true that a false view of dominion has played a role in the mistreatment of creation, but a correct understanding of the concept can lead to service, responsibility, and stewardship. And I truly believe that. Fallen man has dominion over nature, but he uses it wrongly. The Christian is called to exhibit dominion, but exhibit it rightly, treating the thing as having value itself, exercising dominion without being destructive. And the thing that I'm treating the thing as having value itself. I think that that's what we need to do. We need to treat creation and all of it, everything in it, like it has value itself. And I think that the ecologists, which ecology wasn't even a science, I don't think, when I was going to high school. But that connectivity of all living things is so important, and it's something that, you know, we at the top of the food chain don't think about enough until it's affected us somehow.
But unfortunately, it's interesting that Francis Schaeffer would say that. Because unfortunately, his followers went in the opposite direction.
Yes.
Because his followers were, if we help destruct the destruction of the world and cause people the war and Armageddon to begin, the sooner second coming of Christ will be. And then,
yes.
So we could cause the second coming of Christ. I mean, and so they went in the opposite direction, which is, I find fascinating. I would expect that from his son, not from him, from Frankie Schaeffer.
Through the Holy Spirit, we participate in the work of God himself as agents of his common grace, entering upon a lifelong quest to devote our skills and talents to building things that are beautiful and useful while fighting against forces of evil and sin that depress and distort creation. And the we are the hands of Christ in this world. After going through our stewardship process, our strategic planning process in our church, we came up with a beautiful, just a beautiful mission statement. And, you know, we've had a couple pastors since we did that, and our pastor just keeps shortening it down to, we are the hands of Christ in this world.
Do you know who Nancy Peavy, do you have any background in her?
I know that she's a theologian, and I don't remember, I know that she contributed to this Institute of Faith work in economics.
So what kinds of things are she thinking about that we would devote our skills and talents to building? Would it be a building? Would it be a fish ladder? Would it, you know, what kinds of things?
Yeah,
I like that.
She was, I think she was thinking about the talent to build things that are beautiful. She was thinking of gardens. She was thinking of forests. She was thinking of, you know, she expressed later on her section things about mainly gardens and forests, and she said even, you know, the beauty of labyrinths, because there's that beautiful space that you're creating that's getting you closer to God.
Mm-hmm.
So she was a very large proponent for labyrinths.
Mm-hmm.
I read that a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
I read beautiful and useful.
So
and so people need houses. They need, maybe they don't need cars, but we drive cars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those things can be useful, and they can also be beautiful. And if you're devoting your skills towards something that's beautiful and useful and fighting against the forces of evil and sin, wow.
I do think she meant it in a broad way. But I think that later on in the article she gave examples of specifically talking about creation things that were beautiful and useful. Okay. So I went searching. Who are the best who are the best creation advocates in the world? Who are the best creation advocates that we know of? When you think of it, who are the advocates for creation that you know? And I'm not just talking about like your mom or your dad or someone who introduced you and form those connections for you. I'm talking about larger, who have a larger venue.
Jacques Cousteau.
Jacques Cousteau.
Abby.
That's
Abby.
True.
Edward Abbey. So who are some of the people, that larger group?
Scientists in general, I think.
Scientists?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm always totally thrilled by National Geographic.
Yeah.
You know, I think those photos and those articles, you know, helped me understand the connection of creation and culture, because there are cultures all over the world that are so connected to creation around them. So, yeah, those scientists really helped me out a lot in my development.
Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein, they've got some really strong voices as well.
Mm-hmm.
By example, I think the Benedictine communities do a beautiful job. I don't know if they do a lot of publishing or advocating, but they just do it.
Right. The Benedictines, the Franciscans.
Yeah, I'm Benedictine, I know those better, but I mean, St. John's, for example, has a solar farm. They're really working to become totally sustainable as a community, which then shows others what can be done.
Yeah, I think I've seen some Jesuit communities that do a really great job, and some Franciscan communities that are just amazing in the work that they do directly with creation.
What about the little houses?
Little houses?
Mm-hmm. I find those fascinating, but they are certainly advocating, you know, ways that you can live comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
You can have an attractive home. You can move it if you want.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Reduce your footprint. Mike and I attended a class on simply living. And, you know, a lot of it was reducing your square footage. You know, it really makes a big deal, a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
So in my search, I thought, what the heck are we saying? What are the churches saying? Where is our church leadership? Where are they? What are they doing? So so I did quite a bit of research about it. So Care for Creation, Pope Francis and the Catholic Church. There's a lot of information in that link on, I don't remember how many items Pope Francis hit. But it was very important, and climate change was one of his calls to the people of God to go ahead and, you know, let's take action. Let's not be the ones sitting on the sideline waiting for the government to do something. But you're the Catholic Church, you're pretty darn big yourself, so let's see what you guys are doing. So he has sent out basically ask the different areas of the church to make commitments. But I think Creation Care, or Care for Creation, sorry, I think that was just announced this year.
There was an encyclical put out 2 years ago
that
really would be wonderful for clusters to study and discuss how to live out, because it really is well done.
Mm-hmm. Creation Care by the Episcopal Church. The Episcopal Church made a commitment in 2009 that in 10 years they were going to cut their carbon footprint by 50%.
Mm-hmm.
They sent out care packages and checklists on how to do this in your congregation. To all these churches and all the synods. And, yeah, it was really cool.
Does that include just all the members of that church as well? I mean, or just itself.
It was the church building itself. But definitely they recommended that individuals look forward to using it as well, the kit as well. And they made the checklist available. Caring for Creation, Vision, Hope, and Justice by the Lutheran Church. So that's both Bishop Eaton's statement and the publicly engaged church social issues, so our advocacy page. Excuse me. Caretakers of God's Creation, and I'm going to go back to the ELCA one in just a little bit.
Are you going to hand these out? Is that possible?
I was going to put it up on the Holden website.
Okay.
So anybody can pull these down.
Okay.
But I can also make copies of it.
That would be
and
nice.
And have them available. Okay.
That would be nice.
Caretakers of God's Creation by the United Methodist Church. Evangelical Environmental Network. Which, if you look at it, it's Yale University's Evangelical Environmental Network program. And so what they're trying to do is get that connection. How do we get that connection with today's kids? And so they've come up with some programs. And then Creation Care by the Mennonite Church. So, let's see. This was Creation Advocates' Purpose, from Awakening to God's Call to Earth Keeping. And this is what the ELCA published as their purpose. So, if again, if I could get some volunteers to read, I'm losing my voice. So, the first one, please.
Okay. A deeper awareness and understanding of our connection to creation and discovering new ways to live into God's hope and guidance for our lives and world. Awaken to the Spirit's urgent call in our time to better care for the earth in ways that are just and sustainable for all. Embrace a hopeful vision for how we and the generations that follow us can live in the world marked by a loving, healthy, life-giving relationship between humankind and the rest of God's creation, and to be empowered and equipped to find ways to bring that vision to life, both in our personal lives and through the congregational witness to the wider society.
So that's the purpose of their program. And I think they've done a wonderful job of setting up a framework. So I've been through their program and their guidance, and it seems to me that if there's someone within a congregation who feels called to help with this being Creation's Advocate and teaching people in their church to become Creation's Advocate, I think that this guidance document is a real benefit, and it just lays a really good framework for usage. You customize it, of course, to meet the needs of your congregation. So there's a lot of stuff that's been developed by the people of God to make certain that we don't lose touch with creation, that we keep it as important and not as something for us to just take things, what we need on our journey through our path towards heaven. So I'm kind of, I was very encouraged. I was really, just really overwhelmingly thrilled to see all of these churches have these programs. And I bring the quote with me, but it was a scientist who was working on climate change who said, you know, we're really good at figuring out what's wrong, and we're really good at that, and we're actually pretty good at sometimes coming up with solutions to those problems too. But what we can't do is we can't change attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And he called out the churches and he said, you need to do something about this.
Mm.
It needs to be important to you. And I think that call out happened like about 10 years ago. So they started to do things.
Well, it's not just a Christian or a church reaction.
Mm-hmm.
It's very political now, I think.
It can be as political as it can be, but I would have liked to have seen Congress make a decision on greenhouse gases,
mm-hmm.
you know, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 25 years ago when I started in air quality work. I really wanted that. And I've been waiting. And I keep on thinking that we're going to get there, and then we never get there.
Yeah. Well, I think we have to address both of those issues. But to encourage you even more, on a trip I took, and I think you were on that trip too, down from Holden Lake.
From Holden Lake?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There were some people talking about the composting and how they were doing it, even though they were in an apartment
mm-hmm.
complex.
Mm-hmm.
The complex itself was working together to try to figure out a way that they could do that and provide the wherewithal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think, a way people can come together. I was thinking that for my condominium, because
mm-hmm.
We have the garden set up where we can actually grow things. And you certainly have that in yours. She has
mm-hmm.
a wonderful place for that. And if we can work together to do the composting,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have to be political as well. It can be...
Right, right. And I think that's
more emphasis on the other.
I think that's what I'm saying is that I've, you know, been waiting 25 years, you know, worked for 25 years to see if we could get Congress moved along that way, and it's not happened. And, you know, to see, you know, President Obama go ahead and make that commitment for the United States, it was very hopeful, and then to have it backed away was very discouraging. But then I said, really, how have we made serious social change before? Within our communities,
mm-hmm.
within our states, within our, we can do it ourselves. It doesn't have to be from on high. It will become from on high once it becomes enough of a groundswell.
But how, I mean, pulling out of the Paris Accord, there should be rioting in the streets as far as I'm concerned. Not that I'm prone to that, but it's not even a campaign issue so far for this midterm election. And why are we so quiet? Why are the churches so quiet? Why are Christians so quiet? I mean, this is irresponsible behavior.
On the children's separation issue, there was a poll that said that 46% of the people really aren't concerned about the children's separation issue. So because of that, we really don't think anything really needs to be done on, you know, any changes on the administration policy. So this polling place was, I've never ever heard of this polling company ever before. It's a polling company that came in with Trump's administration, so it's how he's spinning, you know, fabricated things. So I responded to them, And I said, every organized religious organization, every organized religious faith has responded with letters of protest to, you know, to the president, to the administration over this issue. You're not bringing that to light. You're saying that it's a bunch of celebrities crying, you know, a bunch of bleeding heart crying celebrities. That's not accurate, and it's not really being an independent pollster. And I will never listen to anything you offer as a poll result, again, because you've shown me how biased you are. So when I look at things like that, and I look at, you know, we're not doing anything about the Paris Accord, all the governors of the Western United States have said, we are going to honor the Paris Accord regardless of what you're doing, dude. So for me, I think it's really important that, you know, did you know that? Did you know that those governors are all speaking out and saying that?
And a number of mayors.
And a number of mayors have as well? Right. But across the country, yeah. That's definitely true. So I think that there's more being said that's just being suppressed. And so we need to have the groundswell, because you can't suppress a groundswell.
Right.
Is this like Richard Nixon's silent majority?
Absolutely. So.
And by the religious right, which was neither.
Yeah.
I mean, for all his foibles, foibles, there was an awful lot of environmental legislation that came into being while he was in the office.
Yes. That is true.
But on the, you know, with these little
Reagan came in that he tried to shut everything down.
You know, maybe I'm just getting to be an old fart and a little jaded, but, you know, we can make these statements. What I'd like to see is a survey of the ELCA of every single congregation and find out what percentage of our congregations are still serving coffee in styrofoam cups.
I agree.
You know,
but you could take that step further and say how many congregations are still serving coffee from another country that gets shipped around all over the place in transportation. So it's like, how far do you want to go down that chain?
No, but what I'm saying is, you know, change starts small.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It does.
It starts small.
It's a series of degrees. You know, it's these styrofoam cups, paper cups, then maybe it's the fair trade. How far do you want to take it? Start at step one.
Start one.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And start one is more tangible than the country it comes from.
Yeah.
You know, it's right there in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
It's something very tangible.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes.
And I used to, the last half of my ministry was intentional inroads.
Mm-hmm.
I focus more on conflict. But I'd also see the other side of these congregations. You know? And too many of them are either focused on the past, which is their natural personality inclination.
Yes.
Just like we have people that,
yes,
you know, it's past, present, near future, or distant future. And more of the clergy are distant future kind of people. So there's a big disconnect in a way. And there's also an inability to make it tangible today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what, you know, we say this, but has this statement by Eaton been studied and reviewed and questioned? How are you going to put this in practice, seminarians, when you are in the parish next year,
mm-hmm,
or the year after, or the year after, as you go through seminary? And are we practicing that at our seminary?
Well, I know that at one seminary, yes, that's happening. Because a friend of ours was a seminarian, he just went through, and he told me about it. And he told me what their practices were.
Yeah.
And how they were trying to make that connection. Now, you know, he got a call to, you know, somewhere in Kansas, And it's a really older congregation, and I don't know how much of it he's been able to implement.
Right.
I don't. You know, I haven't talked to him about it that, you know, in that in depth. But I definitely know that they are telling them, yes, you need to start working on these programs. I think that it doesn't necessarily take a pastor to do this. It takes one person mm-hmm. with right. enough oomph and, you know, vision and passion to do it. It
takes the person buying the coffee cups at the, wherever he's buying them.
Yeah. Or she.
Or she, yeah.
You know, well, transcendental meditationists in the 70s
mm-hmm.
lived on the I don't know if it would be theory or belief. It only takes, or observation, it only takes 1% of a given population to change its behavior, to change the whole population mm-hmm. of a community. 1%. So if your church has 300 people, it takes 3 people. You can change it.
Yeah. And I pointed out in an earlier session that I was in a multidiscipline engineering firm, and the environmental engineers make up, you know, about 3 to 5% of the firm. And yes, we flipped our firm. You know, we changed everybody's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we also helped to make them aware, but that small percentage can make a huge difference. And that's what I'm hoping that we can do. That's what I am investing my time and energy in, is helping those people that want to make that difference. And I hope it's all of you. So I was trying to think of also, so I, like I said, I went right to the churches and looked at all of their websites on, you know, environmental advocacy, and looked through all their programs. And I really think that the ELCA has a good program, but like you said, we need people to implement it. So then I started to think, maybe there's something that just really grabs your heart, and you really want to know what organizations are doing a great job at that. So I went ahead, and one of the organizations that I've spent a lot of time with is NOOC Sex Salmon Enhancement. And that's what they do. They don't do anything else. They work hard to improve salmon habitat.
That's
and my I've spent so much time, so many hours, either raising funds for them or out taking Girl Scout troops to plant trees, to clean up garbage within the habitats. They form covenants with farmers. Farmers allow them to plant trees in the buffers along creeks and streams so that they can keep the water cool. And the farmer is then taking those acres along those buffer acres out of production. But they're willing to do that when you explain the connection and the connectivity. And yeah, it's been wonderful. So we have planted, I don't know, just lots and lots and lots and lots of trees in our community and in our within our county to try and keep these the salmon habitat viable. So they're a wonderful organization because they stick to it and they're true to their purpose. You know, they deliver mm-hmm. in a million different ways.
And that's the actual name of the organization?
It's NOOC Sac Salmon Enhancement Association.
NOOC Sac what?
Salmon
Enhancement.
What is NOOC Sac?
NOOC Sac is a community.
Oh.
It's a river, it's an Indian tribe.
Mm-hmm. But that raises for me in terms of how, as I move into a new chapter of life, how do I think about these things? And this just strikes me immediately as the one that I've been repeating a lot. I can't deal with Syria. I can't deal with the Paris Accord. It's out of my hands.
Mm-hmm.
But I've taken a starfish ministry, and that's all I can do, one starfish at a time.
Uh-huh.
And so this seems kind of cool. I mean, I didn't even know something like this existed, but I've got things in Minnesota that I get very involved with.
Mm-hmm.
So this is cool.
Yeah. I'm going to look to another one of my beloved.
Plus, it's a nice picture.
Oh, yeah, it's a great picture. I talked to several people about Living Waters for the World. It's a, you know, providing, it's an environmental justice type of a organization, and it's just, it's a wonderful organization. How they do it, how they use it to provide clean drinking water for people, it's just amazing. And when we're doing things, we're telling them also how to minimize their impact on the environment around them, because it's not something that they learn. So when we do health education, we're also doing environmental education, mm-hmm. creation education with them.
Could you explain what basically they do and for who? And
why don't you?
Why don't I? Okay. Living Waters for the World is actually a ministry of the Presbyterian Church in the United States. Okay. They've been around, they started doing this 20 years ago. Our church got involved in this about 8 years ago. Basically, we send groups to different places in the world and help the people living there that do not have, that have water that is polluted or poisoned or undrinkable, and we assist them in creating a purification system in their community so that they have healthy water to drink. And it's set up as a micro business, so we basically give them the hardware, the training to do this, and then they sell the water at a below market rate for their area, and it brings in income that they can use to help pull their community out of poverty. So it's an amazing organization.
So how do they do it? I mean, they're not building a wastewater treatment plant like we have down the street from us right now, which also produces drinking water quality at a massive cost. So I mean, how does the cost borne out? How do they do it? What are the technologies that you use for them to be able to do this?
It's a very very simple technology using filtration and either ozonation or ultraviolet light.
But that takes energy, so where do they get the energy from?
One of two places. Either of these communities have the electrical power that they can utilize, or there are solar systems that can be set up, solar electricity producing mm-hmm. systems that can be set up to power the water purification. Mm-hmm. And these are in Central America, South America, Africa, mm-hmm. North America,
Asia,
all over.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that fundamentally one of the issues with those, I mean, so there's energy and there's cost, and then there's maintenance when things break down and you got to get parts to them. So are they just like always in contact with this organization, and so these folks will ship out parts when they need parts, or how does that all happen?
No, I mean, the
classic examples of people coming in and putting in pumping mm-hmm. systems for getting drinking water, and then the pumps break down and there's no spare parts, and then they're back to square one again.
Mm-hmm.
The way this is set up is, I'll say we, just as an example, our church, we have a core group of people that do this. We will go in there and educate them on how this thing works, how to put it together, how to maintain it, why they need to maintain it. It's set up, like I said, to generate a small amount of income. So there's a whole economic model that we go through with them, and
so they can pay their operators, so they can pay for their parts when they go, when they fail. So basically it's a sustainable model, so that they'll be able to run it and operate it and make enough money that they can put money aside for future part needs. And then the program, once there are more than, I don't know, 10 or so in a country, sometimes they'll actually train an in-country maintenance person so that you can then pay that maintenance person to come and help them. And every 6 months, they're doing operator and maintenance training within the country as well. So they all get together within the country and have that operating and maintenance time together to back up. They also do RO systems. We put in an RO system for a community that was downgraded of a talc mine. So the minerals in it were just way too high, and the infant mortality was horrible, and people had lesions on their skin, and it was really a lot, and there was a lot of illness. So when we tested the water and we found out, it's going to cost us more for an RO system, we're going to go ahead and do that. So we did that, and with their small nonprofit, the first thing the community did, which was a farming community, was they bought themselves grain bins. They pay their operators. They, so people want to be a part of it, and they want to help it succeed. They bought a technology building. The first thing they did was they bought a truck so that they could deliver water to neighboring communities that have the same issue. So they didn't want their neighbors to suffer like they were suffering. So they went out and sold the water to their neighbors. They've extended their network. How many bottles do they? It's like 10,000 bottles a month or something like that.
10,000 times 5 gallons a month.
So they've become a little water manufacturing facility, water treatment facility. So, but because of it, they brought a lot of wealth into their community, and they're still not a wealthy community, but they've bought enough to sustain their systems, and we go through a 3-year covenant agreement with them so that we're with them. So when they have their first failures and they do something stupid and, something happens to the system or whatever, we can help them out. What happens is there's a big enough network within countries as it grows that local businesses start to stock those parts. So it doesn't become everybody has to go to Living Waters for the World for the parts. Now those companies, local hardware stores and things like providers like that are actually providing the filters and the parts. So they're bringing them in. So it's been, just the evolution of it has just been huge. From just a few engineers in Tennessee who wanted to do good and help people have clean water, it's become a pretty strong organization. So it's one of those ones that I think just really does an awesome job. So I had another one as an example, and it's just EDF. I have Environmental Defense Fund. I've seen them really 50 years of forging solutions that help people and nature prosper. I've seen their projects really be comprehensive very thought-filled, and for them to make such a big impact in the small projects that they do, that that's one of the reasons why I have them on my list. They're, to me, they're not as personally engaging as like Living Waters for the World is, or Nooksack Salmon Enhancement. But there are different groups that you can locally get involved with. There are different local chapters, but I don't think that everybody has one, you know. So they ask for a lot of money once you're on their list there. So that's kind of a pain in the neck. And then I put in a Puget Sound Keeper. You can make a difference by engaging in citizen advocacy. Take action now. I appreciate them as well. I think that they've done a good job of working with other organizations to get to where we need to be, in paying attention to the ecosystem of our of Puget Sound.
What about groups like Sierra Club and Audubon and some of those? Are they viable in this movement?
Depends on who you talk to.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it might be an individual chapter within Sierra Club is doing a good job. I have not seen it. I have not seen Sierra Club do anything except for on the legal front.
But is that helpful?
There's a lot of concerns about greed that they
don't think so.
That they're being used for greenwashing really harmful corporations, that, you know, oil and gas will donate money to Sierra Club so that Sierra Club will speak well of them, kinds of things like that.
Really?
So
okay.
So a lot of these big organizations right now, it's like they're becoming part of the system. And so it's, I mean, you know, like Nature Conservancy got a property down in Texas, put an oil well on it, drilled the oil, used the oil for other things, but, you know, it's like, do you want Nature Conservancy building oil wells and extracting oil? I don't know. I mean, they took a lot of heat for that. So it's you know, I think you just have to do your research and find out where they're getting their money from and who they're in bed with right now, because I think a lot of those groups now, you know, it's just everything's for sale. Everything's been monetized.
I think that's a lot of my gripe with Sierra Club, is that everything's been monetized. And it's all been about, I just feel like they're keeping their lawyers paid, and that's all they're doing.
Well, I get a lot of requests from them, but I've never...
I do too.
I've not given to them, because I really, it's just not been drawn to it, but...
Yeah.
I mean, Puget Sound is great, but I have Lake Superior.
That's
know?
Right.
And
you
so
do.
I don't know what's going on in that area.
But there are, I mean, I think, trying to remember who I know of who's been doing some really great lake work. I'll find your name, because I know.
Well,
I've done
I'm
some.
Just using that. I mean, I've got Silver Lake 4 blocks from my house that we got to take care of.
Right.
So, I mean.
Yes.
I think that probably the local organizations like the Nooksack organization, I mean, near where we are, we've got tuliomi.org, and I think the local ones, I mean, they're trying to save something local, something tangible, something that you can see, something in some place where you're going to go play and live, and I think that those folks are more likely to be true to their mission.
Yes.
Not trying to sell out, and so I don't know how big the organization gets before you start to be leery of it, but I think the local organizations that are working in a specific region, I think, are solid.
I agree. I just think people should join, get involved, and act, and review the advocacy videos that are online for your church groups. I think that's fantastic. Attend advocacy events when they occur, because there are going to be more and more of them. And, you know, making personal commitments, like Steve said, he's not going to buy any more white napkins.
Yeah.
So, but it's important. It's important. Make those commitments. Make those commitments. I have to tell you a funny story. I had a friend who, we were talking about the bleach napkins. Well, years ago, what were the favorite things about, Xiaomi commercials? They were all about the colors. You know, we were the most colorful toilet paper country in the world. Nobody else's, no other country had colored toilet paper like we did. Oh my gosh, we had all of these colors, and it was just wonderful. And a friend of mine was going to school at the University of Washington in forestry, and he said, what the heck are people thinking? They're putting all this dye into the water system. We don't need dyed toilet paper for this thing. So he made his mom give up colored toilet paper. So his mom was complaining to my mom and some of the other moms in the neighborhood. And my mom's like, well, heck, that makes a lot of sense. We should all get rid of our colored toilet paper. So we had this revolution on the south side of Chicago where everybody eliminated colored toilet paper. And you could go into grocery stores everywhere, and the only thing you'd see on the shelves were colored toilet paper because no one was buying it. So my mom went in and she talked to one of the grocery store managers, and she said, we need more white toilet paper. What's wrong with you? You know, you got all this colored crap that nobody's buying because it's bad for the environment. So then he went and talked to his management, and it was like within one summer, the span of one summer, it was flipped, and you couldn't find colored toilet paper on the south side of Chicago. Isn't that funny? But that one kid's voice made such a huge difference. All right. So if you can convince your church to make commitments, that's where I'd start. That's where I'm going. And then educate your community. Once you've got it figured out with your church, then I'd say go out with the community and spread the word. And we definitely need to take action now. I read this Stewardship of Creation Resources. The Episcopal Church has some great stuff they're doing a really great job with their Genesis Covenant. And this is the Anglican Church's video, which I was unable to download. And then this is one of the things that the ELCA bishops got together and said, you know, what does listening to the earth and its people mean? It means getting out and walking the land and standing beside the river and sitting beside people and whose livelihood depends on that land. It's recognizing that struggle for justice are connected, and then understanding that listening is deeply connected to healing. And then I just threw these quotes out. And it's really funny, that first quote, be the change in the world that you want to see, is really unknown. People keep on saying that it's Gandhi, but it's not a direct Gandhi quote.
Probably Shakespeare.
I was gonna make it Gandhi, and I was just like, I know that was Gandhi. So I thought, I've never verified that was really Gandhi that said that. So then I did this big research. Oh, no.
Probably Martin Luther.
It's just amazing how many idioms we use that come out of Shakespeare.
But I like this one. Never be afraid to raise your voice for honesty and truth and compassion against injustice and lying and greed. If people all over the world would do this, it would change the earth. William Faulkner. And then no voice is too soft when that voice speaks for others. And the last one, but who speaks for the animals?
The abuse of some of the animals are just, the abuse, the people who abuse animals is just amazing how many do.
Yeah. So that was my daughter who said that at age 8 in a public meeting. When they were converting the, how many acres behind us?
130 or something. I don't know.
And it's on a steep slope. A forestry, they were converting it to development. And she had played in those forests for years, and she had seen, you know, spotted owls and different types of owls in the forest, and she'd seen these spotted frogs who are also on the endangered species list. And the city planner said, well, they're not there. And she said, but who speaks for the animals? Because they're there. So whatever motivates you for action, sometimes I just put a quote in front of me for a long time so that I can think about it and go, okay, that's my realignment for the day. I need to realign myself and make sure that I'm focused on things that are important. So thank you very, very much for your input and your time. I really appreciate it. Really appreciate that you're going to go out and make a difference.